The Accidental Asian, Eric Liu. Fear of a Yellow Planet, Rising the Sun. I am bathed in yellow light, my features sharpened by shadow. I am Chinese American in a time of Chinese ascendancy. I am Chinese American, not Chinese hyphen American, not American hyphen Chinese, not American Chinese. I insist upon the distinction. And yet the great magnet of China, pulsating insistently, offers to pull the bottom out, to reverse my polarity. I am Chinese American at the very moment in history when the only power that truly matters in the world is Chinese or American, which can make me valuable, in a way, and vulnerable. There is no precedent for this, really. To be an American, conjoined by blood and myth to a gigantic Asian country, stirring from its slumber, is to experience an odd, foreboding exhilaration. Opportunity and threat are entangled beyond distinction. China, after all, is the scene of this generation's great gold rush, the new frontier for new capitalists. Students today are advised, learn Chinese. But China may also prove to be the scene of this generation's great war, or at least the source of a turbulent non-peace. Either way, an unknown entropic greatness looms in China, flooding forth like a swollen river, and this torrent of fortune and ambition cannot but affect me. And you. Just how, I don't yet fully know. I know only that we are in a period of in-between today. China's status is somewhere between friend and foe, its power somewhere between impressive and alarming, its temperament between passive and aggressive. America, too, finds itself ever more in flux, between a white self-image and a colored face, between a myth of the West and a mirage of the East. For Chinese Americans, association with China hovers somewhere between romantic nostalgia and suspicious activity. But this state of in-betweenness, like the watery image in a developing photograph, cannot last forever. Things precipitate, they form, and they form anew. What is most unsettling about China's rise, it seems, is not just that it tilts the geopolitical balance of power, but that it disturbs the idea that every race has its place. Japan once threatened to do the same thing, defying the centuries-old order that equates color with subordination, whiteness with supremacy. Then, of course, Japan lost the war. 40 years later, it loomed again, until the bubble of its economy burst. Now China is the latest yellow aspirant to the superpower throne. Whatever else happens, it is clear that the emergence of China and the opening of a Pacific century will force the issue of what an American is, what an American can be. That's what is promising about the rising of this sun. But that's also what is perilous about it. Loyalty. Do I seem scary to you? Probably not. I am a friendly-looking guy, not menacing in the least. Do I seem foreign to you? Now that is a more interesting question. What makes a person look foreign? There is, of course, the face. My skin is yellowish, my hair is black and straight, my eyes are brown, almond-shaped. But that is not all there is to it. Context matters, too, at least as much as content. In one memorable photograph from a trip to Beijing, I'm standing in front of the gate of Heavenly Peace at the Forbidden City. Next to me, oblivious to the camera, is a Chinese passerby, my age, roughly my weight, with something like my facial structure. There is reason to think we might be related. Yet somehow it is patently obvious who is the American in that picture. My clothes, college t-shirt, shorts, Birkenstocks, my bearing, arms akimbo, my smile, easy, straight teeth, and something else, ineffable, all give it away. My wife calls this the Eric, but for an accident of history picture. Context matters. Now put my image, so obviously American, under a headline about a plot by the Chinese government to sway our elections. How do I look now? Make it a black and white headshot. Grainy. Are you starting to wonder? Add a caption about my having no comment. Does it occur to you suddenly that English might not be the first thing out of my mouth? Over the last year and a half, I've followed with jittery interest the so-called Asian money scandal. And as I have watched the media political complex use shadowy Asian American figures as a totem for fears of Chinese influence, I've heard a voice say to me more than once, "There, but for an accident of history." Not that I had anything to do with campaign fundraising, mind you, or Asian holding companies, or any such thing. Memo to FBI, this is not a confession. But I did once work in the federal government, specifically the part of the government that concerns itself with national security. I had the highest clearances. I worked for the Senate committee that oversees the CIA, then for the chairman of that committee, representing him on several trips abroad. Afterward, I went to the State Department, and then on to the White House, where I wrote foreign policy speeches for the president. I was entrusted with some pretty heavy stuff, and no one seemed to think twice about it. But then, that was 2 full years before Asian people became suspect again. One of the most recurrent rumors about my kind is that we are disloyal, or at best, divided in our loyalties, ever torn between an outward allegiance to this country and a hardwired fealty to some Oriental motherland. This is the suspicion that justified Chinese exclusion in 1882, and then Asiatic exclusion in 1924. It is a suspicion beyond ideology. Thus our enemies in World War II were, on one front, the Nazis, and on the other, the Nips. The Germans were defined by their fascism, the Japanese by their race. At home, 110,000 innocent Japanese Americans were, under color of law, forced into remote detention camps for the duration of the war. As the Los Angeles Times memorably put it, in defense of the internment, a viper is nonetheless a viper wherever the egg is hatched. So a Japanese American born of Japanese parents grows up to be a Japanese, not an American. Surely there's nothing like that sense of menace in the air today regarding Chinese Americans, or Asian Americans generally. I do not wish to overstate, but I must tell you, when the Asian money scandal first became a story, fed by dark mutterings in the media about subversive plots and Asian agents of influence. I got a little nervous. Was that a sneer I detected in the strained pronunciation of an unfamiliar Asian surname? Why weren't reporters distinguishing between Asian nationals and American citizens? Was it something other than simple sloth? In the period since the scandal broke, anti-Asian hate crimes have increased dramatically. There were moments during the initial twitch of Chinagate hysteria when the veneer of a live-and-let-live society came peeling off a bit, exposing in many of our elites a deeply held intuition that some people are real Americans, while others are just eerily American-like facsimiles. In those moments, I hastily stepped outside myself, watching for a change in people's behavior toward me, watching for a change in my own behavior. I detected none. Then I imagined what it would have been like had I still been at the White House then. Would I have been subject to greater scrutiny? Would my most innocent actions at work, speaking to my mother in Chinese on the phone, doing a bit of personal Xeroxing, taking an interest in China policy, have been viewed in a more sinister light? Sheer paranoia, I know. Oversensitivity. I've never had my loyalty questioned. No need for such anxiety. My Chinese friends and relatives are from Taiwan. They're the good Chinese, the anti-communists, the ones we like. Besides, I've never actually done anything to betray my country, never even thought about it. That should count for something, right? I'll put my worries aside then, keep them under wraps. Forgive me, though, if they manage occasionally to slip through. Diaspora. Sometimes I think I will go to China to make my fortune. I'm not alone in harboring this dream, of course. For a time, hardly a week went by without a reminder that China is the business opportunity of the century. But the siren song that beckons me is not just the ring of 1,000 cash registers opening. It's also the call of my Chinese ancestors. Come back, they cry, like spirits from an Amy Tan novel. It is your destiny. All right, destiny is a bit melodramatic, and I don't really hear those voices. Yet, as a Mandarin-speaking Chinese-American, I'm made to feel about not doing business in China the way Ken Griffey Jr. might have felt had he never gone into baseball. Like someone who squandered an inheritance, who failed to capitalize on a rare alignment of circumstance and skill. I have a friend who did capitalize on just such an alignment. He is a few years older than me, but like me, he is an ABC who spent rather little time as a youth thinking about China or about being Chinese. He went to college, traveled the world for a time, became an investment banker in New York. Around 1991, he went to law school. But he hadn't been there more than a year when he realized that the place to be then was not in some arid classroom talking torts, but in the hurly-burly of the flourishing Chinese marketplace. He quit school and joined with some friends to start a new investment bank focusing on Asian business and China-related deals. Today, he is ridiculously wealthy. It should come as no surprise that I admire this fellow terribly. But still, it is rather puzzling that I should want so badly to follow him to China. I have, after all, no particular knack for business. I have no million-dollar idea to test on a billion-plus consumers. And given Asia's financial volatility, China is no place for the clueless. That I should feel this desire testifies, I think, to the centripetal pull of Chineseness, whatever that might mean, and to the growing allure of diasporan identity. In recent years, as the sociologist Peter Kwong has described, a cult of nationality has emerged around the so-called overseas Chinese. These are the ethnic Chinese entrepreneurs and industrialists scattered around the globe who make the economies of Asia whir and hum. In Southeast Asia, they have come to be known as the Jews of the East. And more than any other group, they have provided the capital to help fuel China's boom. China's boom, in turn, has helped fuel the myth of a great and unitary Chinese diaspora, buzzing about like bees to revitalize the mother country. Everyone's got a reason to sustain this myth. The Chinese government, which naturally wants to encourage the inflow of investment from Huaren, ethnic Chinese business people who want to use their heritage as a calling card or a trump card, the non-Chinese corporate executives who feel they can't crack this market without the Guanxi connections provided by a Chinese go-between, the Western commentators and Asian politicians who want to explain China's growth in purely civilizational terms, as if hard work and savvy planning were Confucian in origin, the many Chinese Americans who may not benefit materially from a rich China, but who collect what W.E.B. Du Bois would have called the psychological wage of knowing that China no longer seems weak or subordinate. It's a fine myth, this vision of a borderless Chinese tribe, but it's still a myth, particularly in the American context. I, for instance, am not an overseas Chinese. Even my mother, who read newspapers for the overseas Chinese, who joins overseas Chinese organizations and attends their meetings, is not an overseas Chinese. She has lived here for almost 40 years. She, too, has been transformed. The presumption, then, that Chinese Americans are merely Chinese people who happen to be in America, who could just as easily be in Indonesia or Malaysia, strikes me as fallacious, even dangerous. For if you insist that you belong to the diaspora, those who belong to the nation may eventually take you at your word. I say all this in earnest. And yet, if I ever had a chance to do business in China, I suspect I might change my tune. I might want to have it both ways, really. To impress my Chinese partners with an insider's knowledge of America, and to impress my American partners with an insider's knowledge of China. The second insider claim is much less true than the first. It is, perhaps, even false. Still, the possibility of profiting from such a fib helps keep the China-bound entrepreneur in me astir. What is diasporan identity anyway but enlightened self-interest? What is Chineseness now but another name for access? If you've got it, shouldn't you use it? Conspiracy. The Jew has infiltrated the upper echelons of society. The Jew tries to buy the prestige he cannot naturally command. The Jew manipulates. The Jew is shrewd but not imaginative. The Jew inhabits a shadow world, wields unseen power. The Jew is not rooted in our soil. The Jew floats. The Jew has too much say in our politics. The Jew wants to run the world. The Jew covets all you have. If a whiff of such sentiment ever found its way into our major newspapers or into the mouths of our political leaders, you can be sure that Jewish Americans rightly would be apoplectic. Apoplectic. They'd want to put a quick end to such talk, and they would be able to, in no small measure, because some of them hold precisely the kind of power that all of them are rumored to hold. Only, they hold the power not so much as Jews, but as Americans. The distinction lost on the anti-Semite means everything to the anti-anti-Semite. Unfortunately, it is not yet a distinction that those with Asian surnames are granted. Not at least to judge from the way the so-called Asian money scandal has played out. For everything that was said about the Jew in the litany above was, in the course of this scandal, said or suggested about the Asian. Yet the complaints were few and meek. And the prevalent view within the smart set was that those who complained were simply playing the race card to impede a legitimate inquest. The scandal, in a nutshell, centered on the charge that the Chinese government funneled money through agents here, including a one-time Commerce Department official and Democratic Party fundraiser named John Huang, to influence the outcome of the 1996 federal elections. Huang and his associates committed acts that were certainly ill-advised, and quite possibly illicit. I have no brief to defend them, whether or not they were in China's employ or control. Nor do I take the allegation of a Chinese plot lightly. If true, it would be serious, indeed. The problem is, there has been far more rumor than fact to this scandal, more insinuation than substantiation. After more than a year of media scrutiny and months of grinding congressional investigation, the Asian connection seems more significant for what it says about Asian Americans than for what it says about our sordid campaign finance system. For the unmistakable subtext throughout has been that Asians in America are just that, Asians in America, sojourners and foreigners. Thus, when we first heard that Huang, a citizen, had raised over $5 million in Asian money for the Democrats, little differentiation was made, repertorially or morally, between contributions from abroad and contributions from Americans of Asian descent. Little effort was made to put that $5 million in the context of an $800 million campaign. Moreover, the suspicion arose that Asian American political participation was but a pretext for a baneful foreign agenda, and the behavior of Asian Americans everywhere was Asianized, so that the hustling of small-time players named Dean Lum or Johnny Chung was said to be typical not of American-style influence peddling, but of the ancient Chinese art of using guanxi for self-advancement. Plying connections for access? What a devious Oriental trick. The fact that Asian Americans could be so easily pilloried, so readily transformed into symbols of corruption, indicates how little power they wield, not how much. That is one of the bitter ironies of the whole affair. Another is that a ringleader, of the conspiracy theorists has been William Safire, a Jew and defender of Jews. Early on, Safire fueled fears of Chinese and Chinese-American treachery with snarling references to favor-hungry foreigners, rich aliens, insidious networking, and penetration by Asian interests. Just the sort of code and innuendo you'd expect from, say, the protocols of the Elders of Zion. America today has more immigrants than ever in its history. More of them than ever are coming from Asia, and more are maintaining ties to their countries of origin. More are entering our political process, and more, inevitably, will commingle domestic affairs and foreign. Could it be, then, that in this age of globalization, Americans feel the old certainties of sovereignty and identity slipping away? Could it be that Asia's resurgence will send money and people spilling over our borders? Well, yes. But surely it is possible to contemplate this without paranoid ranting. For the problem, really, is not that the Asians who come here feel divided about America. It's that America feels divided about the Asians who come here. Citizens. Ralph Bourne, in a famous essay called Transnational America, argued in 1916 that American nationality should be more cosmopolitan, that we should encourage immigrants to come, to mix, to retain their ethnic attachments. Bourne wrote in a time of rising nativism and against the parochial program of the Klan and its sympathizers. America is coming to be, he wrote, not a nationality, but a transnationality, a weaving back and forth with the other lands of many threads of all sizes and colors. Today, his voice still resonates. The America that was coming to be in his time has come to pass in ours. Bourne's solution to the problem of membership in a diversifying nation was to allow for dual citizenship, loyalty to America as a matter of rights, loyalty to the old country as a matter of blood. There are intellectuals today who advocate something the same, who insist that our traditional notion of citizenship is too straitened for this era of mobile capital and fluid fidelities. Aryun Appadurai, a scholar at the University of Chicago, paints a vision of America as an ethno-racial free trade zone, a vast fairground for the many diasporas of the world. Others likewise have called for a regime of plural patriotisms. I share the desire to rethink American identity, particularly in the midst of today's demographic changes. And of course, I acknowledge that each of us has many varied circles of affinity. but I think calls for multiple allegiances miss the very point of American possibility. America is exceptional, not only because it provides due process and a setting for free cultural expression, but also because it synthesizes the many cultures it welcomes. Far more than in Bourne's time, America now is indeed a transnationality, an amalgamation, a seedbed for once unthinkable hybrids. It is precisely in an age of globalization that America becomes the most necessary place on earth. That is why we owe it our undivided loyalty. Orientals. In the 1980s, when Asian Americans became the country's favorite non-white folk, the model minority, Mike Wallace on 60 Minutes asked, "Why are Asian Americans doing so exceptionally well in school? They must be doing something right. Let's bottle it." On this view, Asian American students are something like Japanese cars, imports that imitate American forms but offer better performance thanks to a superior Asian style of development and production. If only GM could bottle that Asian way. If only we could capture the genie. It's a spirit, this Asian thing, a phantasm. Just ask Deepak Chopra, whose progression from endocrinologist to mind-body healer to interpreter of wizards and spirits perfectly tracks today's gold-paved path from Western rationalism to Eastern mysticism. The Asian, apparently, is our modern-day sorcerer, the holder of powerful knowledge. We eat up Deepak's books because they purport to tell us how to find our way. The same reason, perhaps, why so many approved of the caning